I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. All things political coming up this hour. Last week's Senate drama at 1:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, senators who were probably going to vote no on the skinny health care bill. But John McCain, just 2 weeks out from major surgery with a large scar over his eye and a very serious diagnosis of brain cancer, gave a dramatic thumb down, and the Senate failed to pass a health care bill, leaving a prominent years-old Republican campaign promise unfulfilled. What now? Vladimir Putin says 555 U.S. diplomats must leave Russia, a major escalation in the Kremlin's fight against U.S. sanctions. Reince Priebus is now the former chief of staff. Does this make the president a man without a party? Some prominent conservatives in the press are unhappy with the president. We'll talk a little bit about what Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal wrote over the weekend. Our Attorney General Jeff Sessions' days numbered as Attorney General. And why is the president disappointed in him? And Foxconn returns. It comes to Wisconsin with help from Reince Priebus, Jared Kushner, and others. Will the project gain or lose state tax revenue? Those are a few of the issues we'll be discussing this hour. Craig Gilbert is our guest, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and also for the Journal Sentinel Online. He writes about politics on the Wisconsin Voter blog and has been covering Washington politics for 25 years. We'll be taking phone calls and carrying your messages to our guests via a wide range of ways to reach us. You can call at 800-486-8655, or you can send an email at ideas@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, Craig. Thanks for being with us. Hello, Craig. Are you there? Whoops. Craig, are you on this line? Well, we don't know where he is. All right, well, we'll get him back. We just lost the connection for a moment. So feel free to comment on any of those. It was a wild week in Washington last week, and I'm sure that you'll have a lot to say about healthcare. It's been a big subject on this program for really years and years and years. And I'm wondering what will happen now. The Treasury Secretary said that really the Senate should not do any other bill until they vote again on health care. Is the possibility that they could get the votes that are necessary? We will talk about that. We'll talk about what Senator McCain had to say, that the bill did not lower costs. And he was critical of the Senate's inability to craft wide-ranging legislation. He said it was inexcusable and that Democrats and Republicans should write a bill together and stop the political gamesmanship. Do you see that as a possibility, that Democrats and Republicans will be able to craft a bill to make the Affordable Care Act a little stronger, or is that just not in the cards? What do you think about that? It really was a dramatic moment for Senator McCain, who was just right off surgery and made that dramatic gesture really late in the morning. Now let's try Craig again. Hi, Craig. Craig, are you there? Hello. Well, I'm not sure what's going on. We hear him on the phone, but we don't get him on the board. So at any rate, we'll be with you with all things political in a moment. Hour two of our program today. I'm on my last 2 weeks doing this program before I retire. So as you would imagine, you couldn't have 2 weeks go by without an Abraham Lincoln show. So we thought we would talk about Abraham Lincoln. Among my fondest memories are the trips that we took to Springfield and also to Gettysburg in Washington, D.C. We have a Lincoln scholar with us, the second hour of the program, who has written many, many books about Abraham Lincoln. So we will discuss those. We'll talk about Gettysburg. We'll talk about the man of ideas that Abraham Lincoln was, the Emancipation Proclamation, and many other topics of discussion with Alan Welzo, who's a professor of history at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. So he's a president certainly worth talking about and studying. Now we'll try Craig again. Craig, are you there? Hello? And I also wanted to let you know.
Hi, can you hear me?
There we go. Oh, Craig, hi. Hi, Craig. It's good to hear your voice. Hello. There, we got you now. The connection has been established. What a week you had in Washington last week. Oh,
yeah,
my gosh.
Still catching our breath.
I bet you are. I was on vacation. I was way up in northern Minnesota, and you couldn't get, you know, the internet was kind of intermittent. So there I was at 12:30 at night. I should have been sound asleep trying to follow what was going on in the Senate via tweets because that's all I could get. And it was such a dramatic night, wasn't it?
It was. I had one of those vacations about a week before you did.
Oh, did you?
And not in retrospect, very little happened on my vacation. But last week was one of those weeks where we've gone through this process in the Trump presidency of, you know, week after week, day after day. It's just impossible to imagine more drama and chaos and conflict. And then the next week comes around, and last week was kind of a record setter. I mean, when you think about all the things that happened, mm-hmm. When you just think about what happened in a 24-hour period with the collapse of the healthcare effort in the Senate and the firing of White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, there was a lot packed into that week, and most of it was not very good for the president.
No, it wasn't. Let's talk a little bit about Senator McCain's decision to vote against this bill. It was such a dramatic sight, wasn't it? He's just off surgery. He has this big scar over his eye. It's a brain cancer diagnosis, very serious. And he made quite a dramatic gesture, which I think came as a surprise to a lot of people, didn't it?
Yeah, and I have to confess, I did not stay up in the Senate press gallery at 1:30 in the morning for that. I was on the floor when Senator McCain made his return from Arizona. I was in the gallery, I'm sorry, when he made his very dramatic return from Arizona and cast the decisive vote on the motion to proceed to launch the health care debate, mm-hmm. and then gave this very striking speech, which in some ways foreshadowed his final vote that you alluded to, about how the Senate should be doing its business. I mean, after voting essentially with party leaders to begin debate, he really kind of excoriated the way the party and leadership and Mitch McConnell have handled the issue and called for something that, I mean, made it clear everything he said was really suggested that there was nothing he liked about the Republican bill and the process, and he ended up voting that way.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how much this plays into the whole decision or not, but obviously Donald Trump mocked him for being a loser because he was captured in war. Did McCain ever counter that in any way? Did he say anything in response to what the president had said?
I don't think so, but, you know, people, you know, it's fair to read into these personal relationships. I don't think it's fair to assume that the conduct of lawmakers and the votes they cast are entirely personal, but I think it's fair to plug that into the equation. And in this case, you had sort of two relationships that were interesting. One, the president's relationship with John McCain and that history, and then there was also John McCain's relationship with Mitch McConnell. They go back a long way. And, you know, the thing that some of us in Wisconsin remember most about John McCain was this long crusade he had, successful in the end, with Russ Feingold,
yes,
a Democrat, to pass a bill that rewrote the nation's campaign finance laws. And Mitch McConnell was absolutely their arch adversary throughout that whole process. Mitch McConnell kind of wore it as a badge of honor that he was sort of the Darth Vader in the campaign reform debate. And in fact, I went back and I was doing a story about McCain, kind of a retrospective, and I was thinking back to a moment in the New Hampshire primary. It was actually 1999, in the run-up to the New Hampshire primary, and I was on the campaign bus with him, and he was being interviewed by The Daily Show, and it was sort of a mock interview, and they were asking him all sorts of crazy questions, and one of them was, who do you think is the funniest Republican? And McCain's answer was, Mitch McConnell. He makes me laugh all the time. And that was, you know, that sort of summed up his relationship with Mitch McConnell. So at a minimum, he felt no personal reason to vote with either McConnell or Trump, and he obviously also had some substantive reasons for voting the way he did.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about the president's involvement in health care. Did he really lay out a plan that he wanted to have passed, or did he, as some have suggested, outsource the whole issue to Congress?
No, he didn't lay out a plan. I mean, he did, he kind of at times prodded the Senate, and it's often on Twitter, go senators, go, pass health care, do it now. But that's different from, you know, trying to shape a bill. In fact, you know, when the House passed its bill and struggled mightily to do so, Paul Ryan's bill, the president, you know, reportedly called it a mean bill when he met with, I believe, when he met with senators afterward. And so he not only didn't push hard for his own version or try to impose his own vision of health care on the bill, and we saw that in some of the components of the features of the bill. I mean, the House bill contained, you know, in some ways one of the most, maybe the most significant thing about the House bill was these big changes to Medicaid. And, of course, President Trump had campaigned at various times on not cutting Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
So there were aspects of the bill that were just kind of at odds with the agenda he campaigned on. And then, but he did kind of sit back and sort of cheered the both chambers on. It seemed to be his bottom line was just passing something, but not, but again, not a really defined vision of what that should be.
So he said they should have approved health care last night, but you can't have everything. And then again, he's talking about going to let Obamacare implode. You have the Treasury Secretary saying that the Senate should not vote on anything else before they vote again on health care. What's the future here?
Well, it doesn't look good for a bill because, you know, even if the Senate had passed this this so-called skinny repeal, which really did not accomplish a lot of things that a lot of conservative Republicans wanted to accomplish, even if they'd done that purely as a vehicle to get to negotiations with the House, it wasn't clear that where that would lead because of the differences between the House and the Senate. So this process, it hasn't even tested the question of whether House and Senate Republicans can agree on a bill. It's just tested whether a bill can get through the House and a different bill can get through the Senate. And in fact, it failed that latter test. So, so it's kind of a bleak outlook, I think. And then on top of that, you've got the fact that there's other things they want to do, and the more time they spend on health care, the harder it is to get those other things done. But I think, you know, we've talked about the role that President Trump has played, and certainly you can pin it partly on his kind of distance from the whole thing. You could also pin it partly politically on his low popularity. But also, I think fundamentally, it goes to the lack of consensus within the Republican Party on what a healthcare system should look like. And so there are some contradictions there and some issues there and dilemmas there when it comes to pure policy that the party hasn't really worked out yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also looked at the public opinion polls, and they didn't get very many favorable votes from the American public on any of the bills they had put forward. Did that play into this at all?
Sure. I mean, it just makes it harder. I mean, you know, you could argue that it's somewhat remarkable that they came as close as they did to keeping this issue alive, given how unpopular the bill is. I mean, the House passed a bill that polled terribly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the House, obviously, the Republicans have a majority of the House, and so they could afford in the House to lose a bunch of members and still a bunch of their own members and still pass something. But in the Senate, the margin was much thinner. They could only afford to lose two senators, but senators have, you know, statewide constituencies. And even then, you had senators who were up for re-election, like Dean Heller from Nevada, who's going to have a very tough race, and the bill is clearly not very popular in his state, and yet he voted for some versions of this bill, and he voted to keep the process alive at the end. That is a testament to the, you know, political pressures that exist within a political party to kind of deliver on that party's agenda, and to some degree the fear of being primaried within your own party when you're mm-hmm. up for re-election.
Well, and the president shows his lack of understanding of how government works when he's criticizing the filibuster rule after this vote, but the health care bill just required a 51-vote majority to pass, and it still failed. Doesn't he know the workings of government at
well,
this point?
Well, that's true, and you know, he's been criticized for that. Now, in fairness, there is, you could argue that the filibuster rule did have an impact on the debate in the sense that in the Senate it kind of limited what they could do under the so-called reconciliation rule, which, in other words, if they were going to bypass the filibuster and, impose a 50-vote threshold on themselves, there were only so many things they could do with that bill. There were certain things they could not do with the bill. So it did affect, the filibuster rule did affect the debate, but it did not prevent them from getting, from passing the bill that was on the table, the bill that failed in the end.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a long piece yesterday about Reince Priebus, who wasn't in for very long, but certainly rose from being an attorney in Milwaukee some years ago to chief of staff to Donald Trump. What was going on there? Why was he fired?
Well, I think it is, I think there's two things going on. One is that he struggled in the job, and maybe he wasn't exactly the right guy for the job. Wrinkles in all this analysis is that from the moment that he was appointed to the White House chief of staff, he was frequently portrayed as a Washington insider because he was a Washington insider in relation to other people on the Trump team. But I don't think you would normally call someone a Washington insider who's never had a job in the federal government and who had only been living in Washington for, at the time, 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sum total of his Washington experience was to chairman of the Republican National Committee for 5 or 6 years, a very different kind of job, a job where it was really about fundraising first and foremost, and also about kind of working with the 150 to 200 members of the Republican National Committee and keeping them happy, building consensus there, having a role in the campaign. Very different job, clearly, than White House Chief of Staff. So, he was a corporate litigator, and I remember talking to him, and he felt like some of those skills, those were skills he could summon in the job. But basically, it wasn't like he was an elder Washington statesman or someone who'd been around the block already with this kind of work. So there's that. And the perception was certainly afterward that he wasn't a strong chief of staff. But I think more important is the question of whether any chief of staff could succeed under these circumstances. I think I am one of those people, whether you're talking about a White House or a presidential campaign, that believes that it's all about the person at the top. And it's not about the staff. It's not about, the president, the candidate is responsible for the people that are working under them, and they have to make it work. And so I think fundamentally, I'm not sure anybody else, would have done a whole lot better. And we'll see how General Kelly does. But clearly, these were the most trying circumstances you could possibly imagine a White House chief of staff working under when it comes to just sort of managing the person in the Oval Office and kind of managing the conflict and chaos that person cultivate in the White House.
And then the chaos that's created by Anthony Scaramucci and his words against Priebus that make their way into the New Yorker that are absolutely vulgar and profane. I wonder what Priebus thought about that.
Yeah, and he really held his tongue afterward about that. Was asked about it, I think, on Fox and CNN and declined to comment. So there was even one report. This is how crazy this stuff gets. There were some reports that the fact that Priebus didn't push back against Scaramucci was a mark against him for Trump because it didn't show spine. Mm-hmm. And which is kind of remarkable when you think about that, because it was Trump that forced the hiring of Scaramucci and that permitted Scaramucci to do what Scaramucci did. It's interesting. The other interesting thing about the aftermath of all of this is that it really does seem like one of the biggest marks against Reince Priebus that Trump never forgave is when the Access Hollywood tapes came out last October during the campaign, and Reince Priebus was chairman of the RNC. This is very late in the race, and you forget what a bombshell that was and how imperiled Trump's candidacy appeared to be. And Reince Priebus not only issued a public statement to the effect of, women should never be spoken about in these terms. It was a fairly strong comment. And privately, he suggested that Trump consider dropping out of the race. By most accounts, Trump never really forgave Priebus for that moment of what he saw as disloyalty. So Priebus's undoing was partly, or at least this cloud over his head was partly due to his, response to the Access Hollywood tapes.
Yeah, but Priebus obviously forgave Donald Trump, so he becomes his chief of staff.
Yeah, they forgave each other. I mean, right. Trump went on to hire him, and Priebus went on to become quite a cheerleader as well as the chief of staff for Donald Trump. So that's politics.
I find that hard to understand. That's politics, huh?
Well,
that's how it happens.
This is one of those. It's not so strange that things like this happen. It's just that this president has sort of tested our notion of where those lines are drawn, because the behavior is so unusual. And so that for the people working under this president and under that candidate, I think to whatever extent they feel conflicted and face dilemmas in how they deal with rhetoric or behavior that they disapprove of personally, those dilemmas and conflicts are that much greater in the case of Trump.
Craig Gilbert is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political. We'll welcome phone calls and in any other way you'd like to reach our conversation with Craig. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is ideas@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. We have many other areas to discuss with Craig, including Foxconn deciding to locate in Wisconsin, who helped make that happen. And Vladimir Putin saying 755 U.S. diplomats must leave Russia, which is a pretty big escalation in the fight against U.S. sanctions. We will talk about that and more with Craig. Craig has been a longtime guest on All Things Political and other programs as well, and he's with us for this hour. So we'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, two phone calls. I'm interested in your thoughts about health care and what took place on the Senate floor on Thursday night. Very late night vote, very dramatic vote, and whether or not you would like to see another vote, a skinnier or more robust health care repeal, replace Obamacare, if you're happy with that vote, what you make of that, and all the other news that took place last week. It was a lot. Reince Priebus, no longer chief of staff. What do you make of Kelly as being the new chief of staff? Will he bring some order to the White House? Our number is 800-486-8655. And Kevin in Crandon, our first caller. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Kathleen. First point, I believe Senator McCain had already said that he wasn't going to vote for the bill as it was anyway. Two, poll from, I don't know, two or three weeks ago had it that only 17% of the Americans polled were in support of what the Republicans were trying to do. And then I think an even more recent poll has said that 33% are in favor of single payer. So you've got an almost 2-to-1 margin there, according to the two polls. And then, as far as not my President Trump, I think people are eventually going to keep waking up and tuning him out, because if you can't keep your story straight from one day to the next, that's pretty bad. That's all I have to say.
All right, Kevin, thanks for the call. Craig.
Well, the caller's right that John McCain did kind of forecast his vote in that speech he gave after the debate began. Did say he would not vote for the bill as it is or as it was. He did join Ron Johnson and Lindsey Graham at a press conference on the eve of the vote and made it appear almost as if he would agree to vote for this final bill, the so-called skinny repeal, as long as Paul Ryan promised not to turn around and have the House vote on it, because the irony was that the Senate was voting on it, trying to pass a bill that it hated even Senate Republicans didn't like, and they wanted assurances that the House wouldn't pass the same bill, but would instead use it as a vehicle for negotiations. Now, Paul Ryan's assurance persuaded Ron Johnson and Lindsey Graham to vote for it, but not John McCain, because in the end there was no guarantee, even if it had gone to negotiations, there was no guarantee that if the negotiations had failed, the House could still turn around and pass the Senate bill. And then you would have had a pretty chaotic situation, because you would have had this bill that undid some of the Obamacare mandates, which could have, according to experts and insurance companies, really created some havoc in the insurance markets.
And let's go next to Richard in Cambridge. Hi, Richard.
Well, hi. How are you this day?
Fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
I just want to say that any new, Obamacare certainly can be fixed. I don't know why they didn't just start by dropping the state boundary regulations on the insurance company. I never understood that anyway, considering every other insurance that I buy, whether it be home insurance, car insurance, whatever, I can buy from any carrier anywhere in the country. But as far as new health care bill, if they can't just fix that, it's got to be health care for all. Any bill that does not include health care for all is never going to be an improvement. And again, we know what they always tell you about, you can't get your doctor, or you can't get this service or that service. But, if we can, we should be able to do it better. And I want to see health care for all.
Thanks, Richard, for the call. Craig.
Yeah, well, one really interesting thing about the healthcare debate is that, there is a disagreement in politically in the country. I mean, certainly to some degree between the two parties. There are Republicans and conservatives who believe that, who do not advocate for healthcare for all in the sense that they don't believe that health insurance or health is an automatic right, and yet, I think the party was sort of backed into a corner in this debate over Obamacare, where they couldn't really acknowledge that. I mean, they what they were advocating for, even in overturning Obamacare, the president and congressional leaders were still sort of essentially promising more and better health care, but cheaper, as opposed to arguing that we've overreached and that we can't provide universal health care or as much health care as the Democrats are promising. So that kind of muddied up the debate a little bit. But I think in the end, it's probably something that Democrats are happy about, because now the predicate for all these debates is broad coverage, and who's going to deliver broad coverage. And so anything that reduces the number of people who are going to be insured, I think, runs the risk of performing pretty poorly in the polls. I think in that sense, the ground has shifted under the debate a little bit, and that may be that's one reason why it's turning out to be hard to undo Obamacare.
When the president, Craig, says he's not going to give money for subsidies, that he's going to let Obamacare implode, he's told members of Congress if they don't vote against health care, this was after the vote on Thursday night or Friday morning, that to take away their insurance, is there a way that he could let it just sort of dissolve that without federal government support? Can he do that? Would he do that?
I think there are things he can do to allow it to wither. I mean, to some degree, he can. He has the ability to kind of withhold some of the assistance that Obamacare provides for people buying insurance, buying their own insurance on the Obamacare exchanges and marketplace. So he's threatened to do that before. He just hasn't done it. Obviously, it's a very high risk move politically, because once you do that, you're the person people are going to blame,
right,
if the markets explode.
Mm-hmm. We'll go back to healthcare, because I know our audience really wants to talk about this issue, but this is a pretty big thing. The House voted tough new sanctions against Russia, Vladimir Putin saying 755, that's a lot of U.S. diplomats who are going to leave Russia. The president so far hasn't said a whole lot about this, but it certainly was not the kind of cozy relationship that I would imagine Vladimir Putin was hoping to have with President Trump.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's interesting. I've read competing theories about what Vladimir Putin is really looking for in his relationship with the U.S. And one theory is that he does want, that he really is invested in a better relationship, that he wants Russia to be treated better by the U.S. and treated as an equal, and he wants to get out from under the sanctions. And that's one theory. And the other theory is that he's happy to have a very adversarial relationship for reasons of domestic politics, because it allows him to go to the Russian people and portray us as the problem and as the enemy, and that in some ways bolsters his authority in mm-hmm. Russia. So and maybe both things can happen at the same time. I don't know, but we're going to be untangling this for a long time, both in terms of what Russia was thinking when they, you know, decided to meddle in the U.S. elections, and what they expected to come out of the U.S. elections, who they expected to win the U.S. elections, and what these contacts were about, and what they and what they're hoping for from the Trump administration now.
Mm-hmm. Foxconn coming to Wisconsin. Who got them to decide to come here?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I went to the White House and was in the East Room on Wednesday when this was announced, and it was really interesting on a lot of levels. I mean, one, it's obviously potentially a huge deal for Wisconsin. You know, it's potentially a huge deal for Trump. It's just that one of the striking things about, I mean, I think of that moment in the East Room as, I mean, imagine a Trump presidency that was full of Foxconn moments.
Right.
I mean, that was all about jobs. It was mm-hmm. all about bringing factories back to the Midwest, as opposed to everything else that happened that week, which was chaos and anarchy and defeat and disarray. And so, you know, it was interesting in that sense, because it sort of was a glimpse of an alternative universe in a way where you've got Trump essentially, you know, this was a distillation of his campaign promise and his central campaign promise and vow, which is to revive manufacturing, do it in the Midwest. And Foxconn offers, you know, at least on the surface, some promise of that, yet it was a blip. I mean, it was like it took like a millisecond out of the week that was dominated by his campaign against Jeff Sessions and his speech, you know, the reaction from the speech to the Boy Scouts and the firing of Reince Priebus and the defeat of health care and the transgender military ban. So, and then you also had the, you know, all these Wisconsin figures whose careers have intersected with Trump's in really interesting ways in the last couple of years, beginning with Governor Walker, who certainly stands to benefit politically from the Foxconn announcement, and then Reince Priebus, who we've discussed, and in fact the factory may end up in his district, and he probably had something to do with it. And then, of course, Paul Ryan, whose district it's going to be in, and he was involved, and he's politically invested in it. So I think for Donald Trump, it was, you know, he saw it as a way to deliver something in a state that, in one of these blue wall states that he won. And then Paul Ryan, a big deal for him. And obviously this is coming, you know, the real impetus is coming from the company itself. And from what we've read, the leader, the chairman of Foxconn, just became enamored of the idea of bringing some of his production not only to the U.S. but to the Midwest, to an area that has this sort of manufacturing history and does have some things to offer. I mean, it has water. It has, in the case of Wisconsin, has proximity to Chicago and all the networks that brings. And so I don't know enough about the business and about the economics to know what put them over the top, but certainly politically, you know, the alignment of a president and a House Speaker and a White House Chief of Staff, all with, you know, invested in bringing this plant there, had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm. It's been getting somewhat mixed reviews. The President Todd Berry, president of Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, said, "We don't know whether the project will gain or lose state tax revenue. There are some environmental concerns. They're exempt from environmental impact statement. Questions about whether or not more jobs will go to people in Illinois because of where this is going to be located." And really, it's kind of a whole change, Craig, isn't it, in the way that companies used to do businesses? Because it, what's that?
Oh.
Wait. Oh, Anthony Scaramucci is out. We're just getting breaking news.
Oh, my.
Oh, that was fast. Oh, Craig.
Like,
you were just talking about last week. Here we go with another week.
Like a murder-suicide test, I guess.
Bring me a little note about it, if you would. Gretchen or Colleen, bring me an AP note or something, and we'll feed the information to Craig. When businesses used to just come to a place and there weren't a whole lot of, you know, taxpayer dollars going to woo them here, it's a whole different scene, isn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, obviously that's a feature of globalization where, you know, this stuff is production's mobile, and that means that creates competition, and it creates kind of a seller's market for these companies that are locating production, locating factories. I'm reading here that, yes, that General Kelly requested Scaramucci's removal, so that's pretty interesting.
Yes,
so
it's
like Scaramucci kind of like took Reince out.
I know. Oh my gosh. Well, don't take another vacation for a while. All
right. Anyway,
let's go to more phone calls. Mark in Fall Creek. Hi, Mark.
I listened to Michelle Obama on this healthcare thing. And the one thing that I got my attention was that it's something like 10% of the people in healthcare draw down 50% of the cost because they're like overweight. And then instead of, you know, helping them lose weight, we're giving them drugs. And, you know, it's just some huge cost. Like, you know, they're getting a $5,000 bottle of pills every month so their liver doesn't go bad, something like that. Rather than just, you know, diet and exercise. And the thing that scares me the most about this healthcare thing, and there's no assumption, there's just an assumption that a third of the people are going to be diabetic in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. And, how is the society going to survive when there is that level of illness?
Mm-hmm. Emphasis on preventive care, was that a big part of Obamacare? Is that still, Craig?
I think that was an element. I mean, we're getting kind of outside of my area of expertise here.
Yeah. The other thing, though, is the cost of health care. Nobody has really addressed, this is a major issue, and we have all these debates about, and I guess it's gone down somewhat under the Affordable Care Act, but
right.
A major congressional study of why health care costs so much.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all live that. We see it.
Right.
And it's pretty clear that a lot of the policies that are being debated that have to do with the legislation, the bills we're talking about, don't really speak to that and wouldn't necessarily have much effect on that. And it's also, you know, aside from how it affects the healthcare marketplace, it certainly has a fiscal effect because when you look at Medicaid and Medicare, those are big drivers of the federal fiscal outlook, and so big budgetary impact as well.
Right. Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, who knows how long he's going to be Attorney General. Why is the president disappointed in him?
Well, it seems to be for one very particular reason, which is that he didn't recuse himself, from the Russia investigation in a way that and as a result, President Trump felt exposed and has just never gotten over it. You know, it led arguably to Ron Rosenstein, the number two, being in charge. And then when President Trump fired the FBI director, Jim Comey, it led to the appointment of Mueller as special counsel. So this is a big cloud over the Trump administration and over the President Trump right now, to his immense frustration. Now, he contributed, obviously, to that situation by firing the FBI director, but, you know, from all of his statements, it appears as though he regards, you know, he believes that the FBI director should, you know, should be a loyal deputy to him as opposed to a more independent figure when it comes to enforcing the nation's laws, which is really become the vision of the attorney general that that we have now in this country post Watergate. So that's I think pretty simple, and pretty stark, because he was so close to him, and because Sessions was the first kind of, I believe he was the first senator to endorse Trump, and because they agree on some big issues that have helped define Trump politically.
Craig Gilbert, our guest, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're welcoming phone calls for all things political. And our number is 800-486-8655. The breaking news we were just hearing, this from the New York Times: Trump removes Anthony Scaramucci from communications director role. It came from John F. Kelly. It came at Mr. Kelly's request. Mr. Kelly made clear to members of the White House staff at a meeting Monday morning that he is in charge. It was not clear whether Scaramucci would remain employed at the White House in another position or will leave altogether. Our number to join the conversation in the last few minutes with Craig is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network. Craig Gilbert is with us this hour. We go to Eric in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Eric.
Good afternoon. Hey, listen, Friday morning on NPR, I heard Trump say that he's not planning any major shakeups in the White House staff. And I thought, you know, well, of course you're not planning it. But since then, there's been two major shakeups in the last 3 days in the White House staff. It just is bizarre to me.
Is this unusual, Craig, this many shakeups?
It's very unusual. I mean, I believe that Reince Priebus is the shortest tenured White House chief of staff at the outset of a president ever, presidency ever. We've gone through multiple communications. I mean, Scaramucci came on board because his predecessor was out as communications director. And now we're on our second White House chief of staff. Obviously, Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor. We've had multiple press secretaries now. You have the firing of the FBI director. It's been dizzying, and it is, you know, quite unusual. It's just, you know, this is a unique presidency and a unique degree of turmoil at the outset of a presidency.
We haven't talked about the speech to the Boy Scouts last week, which is really something. He just was, and he's speaking of the Boy Scouts, for heaven's sake. And I'm wondering, does somebody write a speech for him? Is Kelly going to be instrumental in making sure that he doesn't really make a fool of himself? He was widely derided. The president of the Boy Scouts had to apologize for the president giving a speech to the Boy Scouts. He just wasn't being a very good citizen. He can't get the size of the crowd, the election victory. What happened in Wisconsin? He's talking to the Boy Scouts, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, and this has happened in multiple settings.
Yes.
I mean, it happened in front of a police group the other day, where he where there was a lot of pushback because of his sort of lighthearted suggestion that the police you know, kind of treat some suspects with, you know, more roughly, and he just has had a lot of, you know, that's just his style. You can write a speech, certainly, but then he doesn't always stick to the script, as we know. So that's the way he communicates. It's just like his kind of fixation with Twitter. I think these are all kind of extensions of his personality, his character, and his makeup. I think he's convinced himself intellectually, maybe, that these are ingredients of his success politically, and so he sort of justifies it that way. But I don't think it's really about, you know, a method and our strategy. I think it's just who he is.
And thank you very much, Eric. Let's go to Marcus in Madison. Hi, Marcus.
So long, Mucci.
Yeah, so long.
I want to go up on that Russia thing again.
All right.
The Russian playbook, if anything, is predictable. And when Obama issued his sanctions, took away the two spy houses, Russia did nothing. And that raised eyebrows the entire world over. That's never happened before. And now it's just a threat of sanctions, not even signed yet. It's been on Trump's desk since Friday. It's been 4 days now. All of a sudden, Russia's expelling the largest number of diplomats ever. I mean, in 100 years. I mean, is not that prima facie evidence of collusion? I mean, there was a deal between Russia and the Trump administration. Don't do anything with this Obama. We will take care of it. We get in office. And when it didn't happen, boom, we're going to go after him. Your thoughts?
We just don't know. We don't know who wanted what from whom. And hopefully it'll all sort itself out. I mean, the one note about, just sort of factual note about this, that there are not 755 U.S. diplomats in Russia. So if that's the number, then that would have to include not just diplomats, but a lot of employees and office personnel and all sorts of other various and sundry people who you would not call diplomats, because that's way beyond the size of our diplomatic force in Russia. I don't know the answer to the question. I don't think any of us are going to know for a while. This is, the investigative machinery is grinding, and who knows how long it'll take to reach the end point.
Well, what's going on with the Senate and House Intelligence Committees? We haven't heard, we heard about Kushner and Manafort testifying in private, but are there going to be any more public hearings?
Well, I think the committees have sort of seized on the appointment of Bob Mueller as special counsel as a way to kind of take themselves out of the conversation. I think they feel less pressure politically kind of weigh in and to do their work, certainly to perform a public role. And so I think their default position is, let's see what Bob Mueller comes up with, and we don't want to, step on his toes. So I think there'll be some exceptions to that in the weeks and months to come. Mm-hmm. But I think that's one of the flip sides of having Mueller appointed, is that it meant that these committees, which do their work more publicly and generate more public information than certainly a special counsel's investigation, would have a lower profile.
One more call, and it's Elena, is it, in Milwaukee?
Hi, I'm Elena. I'm from Milwaukee, and I'm a nurse practitioner. So what I was talking about, what I wanted to talk about, and everything is also seems to be a distraction from this Russia thing, but I wanted to say something about health care, because you were saying, why is health care so expensive? Well, I've been a nurse practitioner and a nurse for 44 years, and I think that the reason why it's so expensive is because we have the insurance companies in the middle being the money launderers. So they scoop up all of what they want and their profits, and they pay all their people, and then we have the pharmaceutical companies who are also doing the same thing before health care is actually paid for.
Mm-hmm. You think it's going to be single payer at some point, Craig?
It's possible. I mean, certainly, if you think about the expansion of Medicaid under Obamacare, that was kind of a move in that direction, because you've got a larger population of people essentially getting single-payer health care,
right.
The more people that are under Medicaid, which is pretty sizable now, and it's a pretty diverse population. So we could get that kind of segmented, steps towards single-payer, as opposed to one day if the votes are there in Congress to actually, pass a single-payer bill.
Yeah. All right, that does it for All Things Political. Craig, I'm retiring a week from Thursday, so
well,
I want to...
congratulations.
Thank you.
And it's been a real joy and a real pleasure. I wish you the best of luck.
Thanks, Craig.
I've had a lot of fun doing your show over the years, and it's been a great experience.
Yeah, we've loved having you as a guest. You're really way up there, one of the very best. And carry on. I'll read you, and
too.
I'll read about Abraham Lincoln.
Go back to that lake. That sounds like
And fun. Go back to the lake with my dog. You got it. Thanks, Craig.
Okay.
Craig Gilbert, our guest. We'll have another All Things Political next Monday. Craig is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and Journal Sentinel Online. Thanks so much to Colleen Leahy for producing the program, and to Colleen as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee. News is coming up, and we'll talk about Abe Hour 2.